It's 6 after 9. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. How safe is air travel? With 11 major crashes this year so far and questions about training and pay at small regional airlines, it's a legitimate question. My guest this hour says air travel is still safe, but there are issues that need to be addressed. Joining me by phone this morning is Douglas Moss, United Airlines pilot and owner of Aero Pacific Consulting. Good morning, Mr. Moss, and welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Well, let me start with the most obvious question. Should the average traveler be concerned about how safe their next flight might be?
No, the average traveler should not have any real concern about the safety of air travel today. It's nearly as safe as it always has been. It's probably the safest way to travel in the world and or any other mode of transportation.
Well, I noted that you say it's nearly as safe as it always has been. Why isn't it as safe as it always has been?
Well, one has to remember that the airline industry has gone through tremendous changes. It's not the same as it was 10 to 20 years ago. The airlines operate under a different business model. There's different types of competition. The economic forces have made a dramatic changes, have forced changes within the industry and the airlines themselves, and they're not the same. The money and the assets available for training, for safety, for employee morale are quite different than the way they used to be. And all these changes have their unintended and negative consequences.
Well, there certainly are fewer major airline carriers than there were, say, 10 years ago, thanks to mergers and, just airlines going out of business. We're probably flying, close to the same number of miles that we've flown? Have the number of miles flown remained pretty consistent?
The number of passenger miles has gone down a good bit, primarily because of the economy. Almost all of them have shrunk considerably. United, for example, is about a third smaller than it was at one time. Other airlines have gone out of business. A few have grown, but it hasn't made up for the overall decrease in passenger travel within the last year. That's been consistent with the economic downturn in the world overall.
Now, obviously, when the news comes on, we don't hear reports of all the planes that landed safely. I mean, you know, the news guy doesn't come on at the top of the news and say, "Hey, a plane landed this afternoon at 3 o'clock and nothing went wrong." We only hear about airline safety, and there's really only a discussion about airline safety when, say, a plane drops into the Hudson River or crashes into a house in Buffalo, New York. So this tends to, sort of skew our thinking a little bit about in terms of how we look at airline safety. What kinds of questions are legitimate for people to ask about airline safety today?
Well, you're absolutely right that most of the news about airlines and accidents is sensationalized, and people don't really get a good perspective because one small thing, you know, bad incident does make the news worldwide, and the good things, you know, no one ever hears about. The real question that needs to be asked is, of these recognized few accidents that we have had, what's unique and what's different about them? The thing that does come out is that even though the failures and problems due to equipment has continued to decrease over the decades, in the last 3 years or so, the percentage attributable to pilot error or to crew failures or mismanagement has increased. So our overall accident rate has just recently increased a little bit, and it's been primarily due to the pilot error and a human error.
Well, there has been part of the kind of the economic shakeup of the airline industry that you alluded to earlier. It has included the selling off or farming out, outsourcing, if you will, by major carriers of less profitable routes. A lot of the routes between medium-sized cities, and this outsourcing has been to the smaller regional carriers. Are these airlines, these small regional carriers, held to the same level of scrutiny, for example, by the Federal Aviation Administration, as major carriers are?
Well, that's a tough question. Yes, they all fall under the same guidelines, Federal Air Regulations of Part 121. So they're all held to the same standards. But it's different whether it's not the same as being held under the same level of scrutiny. And even though there may be the same standards and may be the same scrutiny, the major carriers and the regional airlines work under different, realistic environments. They have different levels of expertise. For example, the major air carriers fly into big cities with the best avionics and navigational facilities. They have more sophisticated airplanes. Their air crews generally have much more experience levels, much more academic education, much more flying experience. And the regional carriers have younger people with less experience. Now, they're just as motivated. They're just as professional. In fact, the regional airlines work generally under more arduous working conditions. They work in worse weather, flying to smaller airports, smaller runways, less sophisticated equipment. So they work in different environments. And so even though you have the same rules, the danger and the challenge in each environment is different.
Well, I guess the reason I bring this up is that one of the back in what was it, February, when the Continental Connection Flight 3407 landed on a house in Buffalo, New York, that was after that happened. There was a lot of comment. There was talk in Congress. I know this came up in the confirmation hearings for Randy Babbitt, who's going to be the next head of the FAA, about safety in these smaller airlines. And one of the stories in a Buffalo newspaper said that the co-pilot on Colgan, which was the airline that had contracted with Continental for the route, the co-pilots there made $20,000 a year less than the bus drivers in Buffalo, New York.
Yes. In fact, the Colgan accident was really a watershed event because it hit upon so many sensitive yet important and significant areas. The first of all is that when they look at the accident and they look at the training, there is a real deficiency in the level of training that is given to the regional carriers. As I mentioned before, they work under the same rules, they get the same training, but yet and this is a general statement, but the pilots in the regional airlines, many of them are brand new pilots, and they don't have decades of experience flying in the military or flying for a charter company or crop dusting. They don't have all of the basic fundamental skills that a seasoned veteran pilot would have.
So where do these pilots come from that are flying these regional routes?
From many, many different sources. Many, or some come from the military, but a large number and a unbalanced number do come from just the training academies where they just have just recently started flying. For example, Mr. Renslow, I believe, was in his mid to late 40s and had spent most of his life in the service industry as a store clerk or a grocery handler. So he was a relatively new pilot, actually, and had not had all the extensive years of training and experience.
So, I guess this kind of makes me feel a little uncomfortable about getting onto one of these regional carriers. It's tough to generalize, but it sounds to me like this is about money. The reason the major carriers aren't flying these routes is that they can't make any money on them operating the way they operate. with what they pay their pilots, even with concessions that pilots have made in contracts over the last 10 years or so. They still can't fly these routes profitably, and so they hand them off to these smaller airlines. How are they able to stay in business without cutting corners?
Well, I think you've really hit the heart of the problem. It all revolves around money. And no one, as far as I know, no one is intentionally sacrificing safety, you know, for economic gain. But it's a reality when the competitive nature of the industry is such that you have to do everything as absolutely as cheaply as possible. You have to take every shortcut permittable by law in order to stay competitive economically. There's going to be some consequences. And all the airlines are in the same boat, and they don't pay or they don't spend resources on things that are absolutely necessary. And unfortunately, this absolute level of necessity has gotten down to only what's required by law. And the FAA standards, even though they may be probably the best in the world, the FAA minimum standards, in most pilots' opinion, and includes myself, the FAA minimum standards are not adequate to really ensure the safety that we want to have.
We're talking about airline safety this hour with Douglas Moss, United Airlines pilot and owner of Aero Pacific Consulting, wondering if you'd like to chime in on the discussion. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll take some phone calls. Here's how to reach us. It's a toll-free number that's good just about anywhere you can hear this broadcast, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you'd prefer to send an email, the address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 9:19. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Here's what's coming up later on the Ideas Network. In the last 20 years, noir has gone global. Crime fiction shows up in places like Algeria, Turkey, and India. After three on Here on Earth, Radio Without Borders, Jean Faraca and her guests track the global gumshoe and the popularity of crime fiction around the world. That's after 3 this afternoon. This hour, we're talking about airline safety with Douglas Moss, United Airlines pilot and owner of Aero Pacific Consulting, and with you, if you'd care to join us. Phone lines may be full right now, but you can send an email. The address is talk@WPR.org. Let's take some calls, and we'll start with Yvonne in Appleton. Yvonne, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for addressing this issue. I'd like to point out that the major airlines put the contracts for flying these regional routes out for bid, and it invariably the contract is awarded to the lowest bidder. And the airlines, the regional airlines that have the better training procedures, the more experienced, better paid pilots, very often lose out because there is some other airline that, you know, is willing to cut corners. And until we stop the Walmarting of the airline industry, the American public, I mean, needs to understand that it costs money to fly people from one place to the other in minutes as opposed to hours, and they need to be willing to pay what it takes, which is probably a harsh thing to say in the economic times that we're in right now. But I would be thrilled if all regional airlines were held to a higher standard of training and experience and paying their pilots a living wage.
Mr. Moss?
Yes, Ivana, you are absolutely right. I think that actually gets right down to the heart of the matter. In fact, if you look at over the past 20 years, think about how much airline tickets have gone for. And in fact, some of the people in the various administrations have said that, you know, airline travel is so much better, than the Deregulation Act is so successful because prices for airline tickets have gone down. But yet, in fact, the consequence of that is that the resources, the training, the quality of the travel has decreased commensurately with that. So, Yvonne, I think you're absolutely right.
Well, let's talk about that, because that was on my list of topics to discuss. I mean, one of the things we did see was when the airlines were deregulated, and this goes back, to the 1980s? When the airlines were deregulated, we did see fares go down, and airlines were competing solely on price. Whereas before, you know, prices had kind of been set, and it was expensive to travel. But the amenities and the service that was available on planes was much better than it is today. And the overall experience was probably better, too, because there was more money in the system in terms of how it was capitalized. Has deregulation been good for the airline industry?
Well, it's not an easy yes or no answer. In some ways, it was good, because before deregulation, there was a lot of fat in the system, if you will. There were a lot of inefficiencies, and deregulation has certainly leaned up the operations. And in that respect, it's a good thing. Travel is more available. More, you know, regional airlines. Well, for example, Southwest, not a regional airline, but it was a baby of the Deregulation Act. And it has been extremely successful, but then it has gotten to the extent where it's really gone too far. And as much as the amenities and services have gone down in quality, so has the quality of the training and the competency of the crews and the morale of all the employees at all the airlines.
You know, and you mentioned the morale thing, and I'm not going to mention the airline, but I don't fly a lot. I tend to stay at home. But I have flown some over the last decade or two, and one of the things that I've noticed is that, boy, I'll tell you what, if you get on a plane where you can tell that the crew is not happy, you're not going to have a very good experience. And in other cases, I've been on airplanes where you can tell that the people who were there were glad to be there and they were happy to be at work. And, wow, that just made everything so much nicer. How serious is the morale problem in the airline industry?
Well, it's a difficult thing to quantify. You know, people are still the workers and the airline employees are still professionals and they still do their job. But it's morale is an intangible effect that can be quite important. In fact, I think Mr. Sullenberger said it most appropriately several months ago when he was interviewed, is that the workplace in the airlines now is not what it used to be. And I'm not singling out my own airline, but it used to be you'd have pride to go to work. You'd look forward to going to work, and you'd enjoy the people that you work with. And now it's not quite the same. It is really just a job. Working in the airlines is not something that I would recommend for anyone. Anyone looking for a challenging, rewarding career in life, the airline is not the place to go. Not unless major changes do happen.
And what might those changes be? What do you think needs to change to make it better?
Well, I think Mr. Crandall, the former executive for American, said it right when he said that the airlines really could use a dollop of regulation. You know, the deregulation has gone too far. Market forces and the race to the bottom of the economic ladder has occurred too much. And the government really needs to step in. I think Mr. Babbitt is an excellent choice be the head of the FAA. He has a real operational experience, and he understands reality much better than most people or previous administrators. With Mr. Babbitt's guidance, I think a lot of the industry can regulate itself a little bit better, but also there needs to be some FAA statutory governmental work to make things better, increasing money for training, increasing standards for training, increasing hiring policies and requirements, and increasing the oversight and the rules, you know, governing the airlines. I think all that's really needed.
You mentioned oversight, and I just wanted to, one of the articles I read in preparation for this program was very critical of the FAA in terms of the amount of oversight that they provided. And one of the criticisms was the agency had been underfunded for some years and hadn't been able to get enough people out in the field to actually do the supervisory work that they're supposed to do.
Well, that's absolutely right. And in fact, with the advent of the outsourcing, things have gotten even worse. For example, most airlines used to do their own heavy maintenance, their overhaul and their maintenance work. And much of that now is done overseas. And obviously, the FAA inspectors, they don't have enough of them to go to all the overseas locations in South America and Asia to do all the inspection work that's being done by these overseas maintenance vendors. And that's just one example. But I think the FAA has been seriously underfunded, and that's one thing that needs to be fixed.
Let's take another call. This time we'll go to Jason in Kenosha. Jason, good morning.
Hi, good morning. I just wanted to say that I'm an employee of ExpressJet. I came over to ExpressJet from Continental when ExpressJet was IPO'd, and ever since that time, there's been just an increasing amount of tightening. There's been several pay cuts, loss of vacation and benefits, and loss of training. Specifically, our new agents, I'm working in the ground handling area, have almost no training whatsoever when they come out, just the very basic, so that they don't hurt themselves with equipment or something. But I mean, as far as comforts or anything resembling service for passengers in a check-in or baggage issue experience, I mean they have, you know, there's nothing to look forward to. And really, you know, the customer is Continental, and the passenger is just another cog in the machinery, and it's very difficult to to separate that out, and customer, and Continental really does put the screws to their regionals. They really do.
Well, that's a very common experience, and I think it's symbolic within the industry. I mean, you work in the service part of the express jets, where you're working with people and their baggage, and not necessarily the safety related issues, but those same economic forces affect the whole airline, and so there's an equal downside pressure on the training and the safe operations of the airline as well. And so your experience is typical of almost other people working in the industry.
Let's take a call next from Richard in Menominee Falls. Richard, you're next. Thank you.
Yes, good morning. I would just like to make a point to both your guest and to basically everyone listening. I mean, the fact of the matter is the issue is regulation, and the issue is profits. And corporate profits are what drives everybody to make the decisions that are being made. Going back to the early 1900s, when you had industries that didn't care necessarily about workers' safeties, and would thought it was cheaper to allow to pay a few hundred dollars for someone's arms to get cut off than it was to protect that worker's arm from being cut off, all the way down to textile workers being burned because people are locking doors. And now we have an airline industry which deregulation has come in and basically said, okay, you don't have to answer to anyone. And then corporations like the airlines are looking to make their profits. So why else would an airline cut these issues? Why else would an airline do these things, or any corporation do these things? It's all for the sake of profits. And you made a point a little earlier about it. You thought it was about money. It's all about money. It's all about money about the current issues that we're having with health care. It's all about all of the issues that drive the entire United States economic issues here. We're a corporate-run country, and everything that's dictated is dictated by corporate profits. And so as long as corporate profits are what's going to drive the industry and drive this country, people can just basically, it's a crapshoot of whether or not you're going to have a pilot that's completely incapable of flying you from one destination to another and is going to pull back on the stick and instead of push forward on the stick when they in a given crisis situation. So thank you, Ronald Reagan. There's the reason why we are where we are. Deregulation. And until we decide we're going to start regulating these issues again, we're not going to, we might as well just not worry about it. Thank you.
I think you bring up the essence of capitalism, and we still are a capitalist society, and there's nothing wrong with profits. I mean, profits, you're absolutely right. Profits is what drives everything, and there's nothing wrong with profits in and of themselves, but the problem is the amount of regulation, and are those all those are profits appropriate? And I think that's the critical issue. Are we balancing the level of regulation, the level of oversight, and its associated costs properly with those profits? And I think that's what the real issue is. So we don't need total regulation, but we do need probably a good bit more.
I want to go back to something that a previous caller, I think it was Jason, who was a worker in an airline that was a feeder for Continental, and he said that there was the big change happened when the company he was working for had an initial public offering. In other words, they all of a sudden had public shareholders. And you know, is that one of the issues here? I mean, if I know that just I'll give you an example from another industry, broadcasting, which I'm familiar, and radio stations, commercial radio stations used to be much more profitable when they were individually owned by owner operators who ran the thing and took their money at the end of the year. Then later on, when they became parts of huge groups that were publicly owned with responsibilities to shareholders and large debt service, then things became much less profitable. Is there a similar issue in the airline industry?
There are similarities. I think when a company is held private, you have people running the show that actually know the business. You know, they understand the product. They know what the people, their customers want, and they can make appropriate judicial decisions on how much to pay for what things. However, once a company goes profit, goes public, it gets very large. You have influence from outside investors. You have people that come in to run the organization that are financiers, or they come from the business world, but they don't know the essence or the heart of the operation. And that's where I think the real bad decisions get made. It's when they're made for economic reasons without an understanding of the consequences their decisions have on the real operations. So it's a matter of having the right people in charge. And in the deregulated world, you don't have as many of the right people running the show.
Let's take a call from Captain Joe Packard in Madison. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you this morning?
Fine.
I have a couple comments with you. I'm a check airman and an examiner for a carrier, and I'd just like to comment that the training standards are still upheld. I mean, our captains every 6 months, of course, are doing their PCs and recurrent once a year unless you're on a one-year program. So I don't want people to think that flying is not as safe. But I would like to comment on what you did say about the deregulation. And when you can drive cheaper than you can fly, there's something wrong, because the overhead has not gone down. In fact, it's gone up. And even though the equipment is a little bit more economical to operate, there's definitely something wrong with the program. Some of these people that we do employ with the experience levels that they do have, people have to understand that a first officer in an aircraft is nothing more than a captain in the waiting. And you're not going to find high-time first officers unless you are at a major carrier. But for a regional aircraft, the first officer is basically a trainee. And they have to be taught through IOE and through training to do things the proper way and follow rules and regulations.
Well, Joy, you're absolutely right. And, in fact, my hat's off to all the people in the industry, the chair chairman and the people that who are maintaining the standards despite the reduction in pay and benefits and all of that. But you're right in that especially in the regional world where the first officers, many of them are right off the street, they're trainees, and the regional airline, any airline, really doesn't work as a training organization. They have their trained departments, and they give them the mandatory government-required training, but that is not really sufficient. For example, look at Colgate Air, where in their checkout program in the Dash 8, they don't do any stall training. They do the standard maneuver for stall avoidance, but they never got training on the stick shaker. They never got training on the stick pusher. They'd never flown an airplane through a stick pusher event. So the amount of training to build a pilot, not just check them out in the equipment, but to give them all the basic essential training that a pilot needs just isn't there. And that's just an unfortunate point. And especially your point about it's cheaper to drive now than it is to fly really is a reflection of how far things have gone.
Thanks for that call, Captain Packard. One of the things that we mentioned action in the House of Representatives and in the Congress, the House is actually considering in its reauthorization bill for the FAA for the next 4 years, it's considering mandating a study of all commercial airline pilot training and certification programs. You'd welcome that, wouldn't you?
I would, certainly. I think that is a very positive event. The more that the government entity in Congress can learn about the status of the industry, I think it is a good thing.
Now, you mentioned stick shaker and stick pusher incidents. Could you give me a little more description of what are you talking about there?
Okay, in airplanes, when they get to a very slow speed, the air flying, going over the wings is not enough to keep the airplane in the air. So you want to avoid going too slowly in an airplane. Commercial airlines, in fact, most airplanes, have a stall warning device to warn the pilot of when they're getting too slow. In this Dash 8 airplane that what crashed it, in New York back in January, February, it has two systems. One is a warning device, and one is a recovery device. The warning device is called the stick shaker, and it comes on, and it vibrates the control column to give the pilot a warning, a tactile cue that he's getting too slow, and he needs to speed up, he needs to add thrust, and he needs to lower the nose to gain airspeed. If the pilot ignores that and continues to get slow, and the airplane approaches, gets real close to a stall, then the airplane will activate its stick pusher, which the airplane itself pushes the control column forward. There's an actual pusher there that jams the control column forward to physically push the nose down to allow the airplane to gain airspeed to recover. Now, in the training scenarios, they train with the stick shaker. They get to feel the stick shaker, and they immediately recover from it. But the recovery procedures are designed to work only on the, when the stick shaker initially comes on. And they get no training on the stick pusher. They get taught about it in classroom. But they never get a chance to feel how the stick pusher works. And actually flying through a stick pusher, which you need to allow it to work for the control column to go forward, but then you need to bring the control column back to start flying again at the right time. And that is a practiced, skilled event. It requires hand-eye coordination. It requires practice doing it. And the FAA does not require pilots to get any of that training. I think the FAA assumes that people, because of their thousands of hours of experience, have enough experience in that to do it appropriately in an airline. Mm-hmm. But as in Captain's Rinslow's case, he didn't have the experience to do it.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we have some more callers who want to join us, and a line is open for you if you'd like to participate in the program. Here's the phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. You can also send an email. The address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 9:43. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn this week on the Ideas Network. Here's what's coming up later on today. In fact, next hour. My guest next hour says making small personal changes to improve society and the environment might make us feel good about ourselves, but have little impact on the greater political sphere. We'll talk about that next hour. This hour, we're talking about airline safety. With our guest, Douglas Moss, who's a United Airlines pilot and owner of Aero Pacific Consulting. Well, Mr. Moss, let's talk for a moment about the kind of airplanes that are being flown on a lot of these regional carriers. I mean, when we watch movies and they feature large airplanes, for one thing, there appears to be a lot more space in them than there really is in truth, but that's another story. We're talking about the really big planes that the major commercial flyers, airlines fly. The 747, the 707, there's that brand new one that Boeing just came out, the Airbus, that kind of thing. What kind of planes are these regional carriers flying?
Well, that's probably the good side of the equation. The regional airlines in general have the newest, most modern equipment. In fact, if you get on an airplane and you poke your head inside the cockpit, you'll see these nice, beautiful LCD screens in the cockpit. The best avionics really in the world. So the quality of the equipment they operate is second to none. In fact, a lot of their equipment is not as big, but a lot of it is more modern than what they have in the major airlines.
So the real issue there regarding safety is on the human side.
In my opinion, it definitely reflects the human side. The equipment is better or as good, and it's really a matter of the training of the individuals and the sources from which the airlines get people from.
Okay. Let's take another call. This time it'll be Paul from Flinger. Good morning,
hey,
Paul.
Good morning. Let's face it, all the Naval and Air Force pilots, fighter pilots that come out, that depart, are snapped up by them by the Intercontinental Airlines because they are the very best. $4 million training, and they fly aerobatics continually during their flight training. So therefore, the regionals hire pilots that come out of civilians of flight school, and let's say he's got 2,000 hours. 1% is in landing and takeoffs, and probably zip is in any kind of upset training where they're flying outside their envelope of. Say 25 degrees of pitch and 45 degrees of a bank, and they don't have a clue what happens in an upset situation, and that's where you have catastrophe. So the problem is going to be we should mandate by law that pilots have to have every 2 years or maybe every 1 year recurrency training in upsets where the plane is all of a sudden because of atmospheric conditions you're at 120 degrees. A bank, and what do you do? And there's definitive procedures to follow, and a passenger should go to a website. It's called APS Training, and take a look at what 11,000-hour naval pilots do to recover when a plane is upside down and either in a stall or in a plunging condition. Clearly recoverable if you have, in the heat of the battle, you keep your wits. That's what should be mandated, because clearly they spend their whole life flying straight and level, 1% landing and takeoff, and in the catastrophic atmospheric conditions, they have nil training. And that's and you have what you hear on the national news. Thanks.
Well, Paul, you bring up an excellent point, and you're absolutely right in that especially in the years past, where the over probably 50% or more of the people, you know, pilots going into the airlines had a military background. And in the military, you build up a wealth of experience in acrobatics and stall recovery, and your whole life revolves around flying an airplane at the edge of the envelope. And that's an excellent foundation, you know, for a pilot. And nowadays, especially for the regional airlines, they have people coming right out of flight school, and they might only have 200-400 hours of flying time, and all of that is in the quote, airline environment, where it's really just one takeoff, a lot of cruise, and one landing. And those pilots oftentimes don't have, you know, the fundamental experience on edge of the envelope maneuvering. And so you bring up an excellent point. And you're right, the airlines do have formal upset training, but it's something that you do once a year, and it's just for a brief, you know, 2 minutes in a simulator, and it's really a set of procedures that you go through to recover an airplane from an unusual attitude. And I don't think the answer is in procedures. The answer to this issue really is in the overall training and the overall background. And I think that the FAA and the airlines really need to provide more training in unusual attitudes and have a bigger breadth of experience for their pilots.
Louise in Milwaukee, you're next. Good morning, Louise.
Good morning. My question kind of goes back to the money, and this time on the part of the consumer. We continue to get ads for getting credit cards for a particular airline in the mail, and the promise of big 30,000 miles or something like that. What does a frequent flyer mile program at all affect the policies of the airlines that you're talking about with respect to training and the bottom line?
Well, I don't have any expertise really in the management of the frequent flyer programs. I really think that's just a business angle. And as far as the operations for the airline goes, you know, the safety impacts, the type of frequent flyer program they have is not a factor. It just all goes to the bottom line, but doesn't directly impact the operations.
Michael in Whitefish Bay, you'll be next. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning. I have an anecdote and then a question. I am a physician, and I had a patient who was a flight maintenance mechanic. This was in Chicago at O'Hare. And one day he came in, I noticed his insurance changed to a way cheaper policy. I asked him what happened if he changed jobs. He says, well, I'm still a maintenance mechanic at O'Hare, but since deregulation, we had the collective bargain where before each airline had its own dedicated crew of mechanics. He was with American before. Now one crew serviced all the airplanes there, with the sole exception of Lufthansa, which kept their own dedicated crew of mechanics. Anyway, my second my comment, which has a question, is that once I flew to Hawaii with a friend, and on the way back, our plane was delayed and delayed and delayed, and I was a member of Ralph Nader's Raiders newsletter then, and I remember reading that if a plane was delayed for mechanical reasons, you had a right to ask the steward what the problem was. So I demanded an explanation from the steward after about 5 hours of waiting. He told me that the plane had flown from Chicago to Minneapolis and lost 3 quarts of oil in one of the engines. At Minneapolis, they inspected it, couldn't find where the oil leak was. They flew it from Minneapolis. They topped it up, flew it to Los Angeles. It lost 11 quarts on the way there. Again, an inspection didn't reveal any obvious leak or anything, so they topped it up and flew it to Hawaii. On the way to Hawaii, it lost 17 quarts, and they landed at the big island at Oahu, and that's where the delay was. They were looking for this leak, and that sort of alarmed me. So I canceled my flight and and took another airline in the morning. But from what I understood, they just topped it up again and flew all the way back to the U.S. over the Pacific with one faulty motor. I didn't read about any catastrophe, so apparently it made it. But I was wondering, who makes those decisions? This plane was flying with one defective motor, and it's still, from what I understand, they topped it up and flew back over the Pacific. Who makes those decisions as to whether a plane is flight-worthy or not? Thank you.
Well, it's an excellent question, and there's not necessarily a simple, easy answer to that. Oftentimes, it's a corporate, it's a bureaucratic decision not made by one person. Oftentimes, the airplane was in Chicago, then it's in Los Angeles, and every time it's serviced by a different crew, they're looking at the same airplane log and records, but they don't necessarily know all the information about that airplane and about that history, and so they make their best judgment to make a decision based upon the information they have. And the airlines, the FAA does mandate a fairly stringent maintenance protocol. You know, if the airplane does lose so many quarts per hour, then there are certain procedures that it has to do. And in my mind, the airlines really are upholding to that. You know, there's no violations of the maintenance procedures for these things. The ultimate decision, you know, also is the captain. The captain has a chance to look at that history of the airplane, and he can make a decision. He can turn down any airplane if he thinks that the airplane is not safe to fly. But other than that, it's the local mechanic and the on-station maintenance manager. And so it's sometimes a group of people that come to a collective decision. And sometimes things do fall through the cracks. It's very rare. But those kinds of experiences are not unusual. You know, they do happen, and fortunately, most people never hear about them, and no consequences made of it.
Let's take another call from Mario in Milwaukee. Okay, as soon as I push the right button, we'll get Mario in. There we go. Hi, Mario.
How are you?
Great.
I'm driving in a car. I'm not from here, but I'm very intrigued by this this topic. I've been a manager and a district sales manager in retail for many years. And for anybody who says that positions need to be paid more, they should just look at the CEOs of these large companies making millions of dollars that ran the companies into the ground that we're now paying for as taxpayers. And it should just all be based on accountability. What my question is, if the airlines have made a bad decision in hiring somebody, how difficult is it to get rid of an employee based on performance? Are these union positions? Is there a lot of red tape? Is there a lot of documentation?
We get it. Yeah, I want our guests to be able to respond, and we're almost out of time.
Okay, Mario, a very good question. Most of the positions are unionized, and it is somewhat difficult to get rid of a individual, for example, a pilot who's failing check rides. However, the union has a vested interest in maintaining their standards and quality, and there are, you know, groups within the union, you know, called the professional standards, that do work very hard to make sure that the the pilots are adequately trained and experienced. And so it's a two-edged sword, but there's enough, just suffice it to say, there's enough safeguards in there where we only keep the best people. And pilots will not tolerate having an incompetent colleague flying airplanes.
We are in the last minute of the program, so I want to kind of wrap things up and get a summary here. In spite of all of the things that we've talked about in this hour, you started the hour by saying that, in general, airline travel is still safe. What needs to be done to keep it that way?
Some increased degree of congressional oversight, some more aggressive FAA oversight, and a recognition within the flying public that safe airline travel costs money, And we really need to break away from the habit of going online and looking for the cheapest ticket. We need to think more about our consumer choices and actually be willing to pay for the appropriate level of service that we want.
I believe that's a great place to leave it. Thank you very much for spending this hour with us. Appreciate it.
It's been my pleasure.
Douglas Moss is United Airlines pilot and owner of Aero Pacific Consulting. He joined us by phone this morning. Robert Schroeder produced this program. Jolema Noel handled on-air production duties. If you'd like to listen to it all again, you can go to our website, WPR.org, and click on the Kathleen Dunn Show link. And sooner or later, today's 9 o'clock program will show up there. You can also order one from the radio store by calling 800-747-7444. Ask for program 805D, as in D. Coming up next, we'll talk about how personal action doesn't mean the same thing as political action. That's our next hour. Stay tuned. The news is next. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. It's the Ideas Network.